This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we take a look at the 2021 events planned by AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. In the news, Bombardier is ending Learjet production, United Airlines invests in eVTOL, VFR charts move to a 56-day production cycle, F-35A engine issues impact the demo team schedule, and a TSA agent saves the day for some confused passengers. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 641 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hi, everyone. Looking forward to a great show, though Max gave me trauma because he's bringing back old memories of Thunderbird lists and Blue Angel lists before the show. But looking forward to a great discussion tonight with one of our favorite organizations.
Yeah. We had a little impromptu quiz with David, but he passed admirably. Although, you know, with David's information, you never know if he's faking it or not. I know he's not, but if he did, you'd never know it. All right. So with us also is Max Trescott, the other Max. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hey, Max, I am all charged and ready for this conversation. I just had something that's new to the San Francisco Bay Area. It's called a Dunkin' Donut. Oh, my goodness. Believe it took that long to get to the Northwest here? Yeah, absolutely. Now, I had, 40 years ago, I had a misspent youth in my college years in Media, Pennsylvania, in the Dunkin' Donuts there. So I'm very, very familiar with this this high charging potential. Happy that it's here now.
That's next thing you know, it'll be Wawa.
Oh, yeah, I remember Wawa in southeastern PA, of course.
Of course. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Chris Eads. He's AOPA Senior Director, Outreach and Events. Now, Chris is a private pilot. He's been an AOPA member since 2001, and he began working for them in 2013. Now, Chris flies VFR all over the country, both for fun and as part of his role leading AOPA events and regional fly-ins. Chris, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
It's great to be with you guys, and good to be with Max Trescott, who's worked with me a number of times at AOPA fly-ins, and to meet Max and David for the first time tonight. So great to be with you guys.
Yeah, good to have you. Now, you know, Chris, I was devastated last year by the cancellation of so many aviation events, and with few exceptions, the first half of 2021 is not what we were used to pre-COVID. I hate that term pre-COVID. It's become a,
it's kind of a thing now, isn't it?
It is kind of a thing now.
Yeah.
But you know, I imagine event planning must be a nightmare, and we're excited to have you with us this episode to hear about how AOPA is approaching events this year.
It's really been a wild year for everyone, you know, and of course, the whole nation and world really has struggled with COVID. But for event planners in particular, it's been a challenging year. We spent more time unplanning events than we have planning. But we really are excited. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys about what we're going to be doing in 2021. We think we've got some ideas that will fit into the culture and the world as we see it going forward. So excited to be with you.
Excellent. All right. Well, we've got that coming up. But first, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from the East.
Let's do it.
All right, we'll kick it off with an item from CNN. This is Learjet, once the go-to private plane for celebrities, is ending production. Now, Learjet, of course, is owned by Bombardier. They say that they will stop production later this year. Bombardier said that they will concentrate on the Challenger and Global aircraft, which are more profitable. But the company's got an interesting history. David started in 1962 by Bill Lear. And I think entry into service was 1963.
For the longest time, it was the ultimate status symbol business jet. I mean, it's been shows up in songs like Carly Simon's song, and it was flown by the stars, and it looked good. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate that we're going to lose an aircraft that looked fast and represented the elite all those years, but it's been around a long time.
It originally goes back to a company that Lear formed called the Swiss American Aircraft Corporation, located in Switzerland. But that didn't last too long, and the operations were moved. But I understand that the first Learjet was actually adapted from a 1950s era Swiss ground attack fighter aircraft, the FFA P-16. So I wasn't aware of that origin until I did a little bit of research today.
It's a class of aircraft that most, as this article points out, that most people don't want. It's holds 5 to 7, and it's, you know, anybody who wants a fast business jet wants more people. So there we're talking about Globals and Challengers. So I guess it's just its time has come, it's just unfortunate because it's always been one of my favorite aircraft, up and including my 1972 Matchbox Skybuster Learjet in its bright little yellow and white body. So they will be missed, though I'm sure they'll be flying around for a long time.
Well, and there's another factor as well, too, in talking about the 5 to 6 place jet market, and that is that the Phenom 300, of which they've sold about 500 of them now, is lower priced. So I think they just got undercut by the competition. Also, the Phenom 100, which is even less expensive. So that's part of the changing market. Now, we've talked on this show for years about the restructuring of Bombardier, and they've been selling off low-performing units. They've had a huge amount of debt to pay down, which is why they've been selling them off. We talked here about when they sold the C-Series, their airliner, which was sold off to Airbus. And this, of course, is going to be job cuts all over the place. In a separate article, I saw that I think about 300 people will lose their jobs in Wichita, which is where a lot of the production is based. Another 700, I think, are being lost in either Quebec or Ontario, because there's some being lost in both provinces. I forget which one was the most, but one was 700 and the other was 100. So big impact all the way around. It does really make Bombardier, instead of the conglomerate that it was with all kinds of different things, including a rail car business, very much a single, you know, business entity. And you know, we've talked in the past how if you look at a lot of the business jet companies, they've got multiple businesses. Textron's a great example. And so this is really, I think, going to make them highly subject to the ups and downs of the market. Now, fortunately, the market's in an upturn. Business jets are selling well. But boy, this will be a real challenge for them in the future, I think, when there's a downturn in the market.
You know, Bill Lear, William Powell Lear, was also an interesting guy. Of course, he died a long time ago in 1978, so it's been quite a while. And we've mentioned before that he actually invented the 8-track, which many of our younger listeners are not going to know what that is.
Yeah, Max, tell us, what is that? Because I don't know what an 8-track is.
Yeah, I had one of those in my truck back in the would have been in the early 70s. But he was a self-taught engineer. But you know what I didn't realize is that he was actually a Collier Trophy winner, but not for the Learjet. Do you know what he won the Collier Trophy for, David?
No, I didn't know he won a Collier Trophy.
He did, for the F-5 autopilot.
The F-5 autopilot was for the Learjet, not for an F-5.
That was a test, David. You passed.
Okay, well, just double-checking.
Very good. Oh, man. So, Bombardier says that they're going to continue to support the aircraft, of course. I mean, that's encouraging and really to be expected. But, yeah, it's kind of sad to see an old name like that disappear. All right, we have from MarketWatch. Archer Aviation gets $1 billion order from United Airlines on the same day it announces a deal to go public. Max, United Airlines. United is getting interested in eVTOL aircraft.
I thought this was interesting from a number of perspectives. When I think of eVTOLs, I've kind of thought that if they really do become a major force in the market, that it might be companies like Uber that are, you know, deploying them. And it hadn't really occurred to me that, you know, mainline airliners might be major players in them. But it makes sense. Now, obviously, they wouldn't use them on their existing routes because they're, you know, very short, you know, distance limited. This particular one they're talking about has a limitation of 60 miles. It would fly at 150 miles an hour. So almost no airline routes are only 60 miles. But they are saying that this could play a major factor in metro areas like Los Angeles, where they might be flying passengers in from, you know, all throughout the metro area into LAX to, you know, meet flights there. So yeah, this is kind of an interesting development for, you know, first of all, for the size of it. You know, this is a billion-dollar order, though the order is contingent upon Archer meeting performance specifications. So, you know, if the aircraft doesn't perform as planned, then, you know, it's not a billion-dollar order. I drove by the headquarters, at least I think it's the headquarters for Archer, which is right across from the Palo Alto Airport. And it's kind of funny. It's a pretty small, you know, building. When I went by there, what day was it? It might have been Saturday. But anyway, you know, no cars in the parking lot, pretty small building. You know, I'm guessing that probably like everybody else, they're mostly working at home these days. But it'll be really interesting to watch this aircraft emerge. It's six electric motors. We have a mock-up photo of it. I don't think they have a flying prototype yet, but I'm sure they're going to be having one soon.
I think they're supposed to unveil the full-scale eVTOL prototype sometime this year, and I think they're looking at production in 2023, but we know how accurate those predictions tend to be. But yeah, certainly a lot of big players. And Dave and I talked about this some on last week's UAV Digest podcast as well. But Archer has merged with Atlas Crest Investment Corporation, and so that that takes them public. So we're not giving anybody stock advice here, certainly. But if you want to invest in the budding urban air mobility market, that might be an opportunity. So, yeah, Chris, I don't know if someday we're going to have a whole flock of eVTOL owners and pilots joining AOPA, but I mean, it certainly is a growing area.
It really is, and it's an interesting area. And I think that AOPA obviously will be very interested, and we already are very interested in watching that unfold. I know that there's been quite a bit of attention paid by our media folks to watch that and think about it, and our technical folks that looking at that progress. So it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
Yes, yes. All right, let's see. What do we have next? Launchpad sent this in. This is actually from AOPA. VFR charts to go on 56-day publication cycle in 2021. Now, this was actually something that the FAA announced previously, that they would put these VFR charts on this 56-day publication schedule. But that's almost the total sum of my knowledge of this issue. So for our pilots there, what does this mean as a practical matter?
Boy, I guess it means that changes that you know, we've been seeing come out on VFR sectional charts only every 6 months will now make it sooner to pilots. And if you look at a typical sectional, which, you know, probably covers an area that might be you know, a few hundred miles, you know, up and side, you know, up and down and sideways, on each of those charts, they usually have over 100 changes in every 6 month cycle, and it's usually small stuff that you may not notice, you know, frequency here, you know, things like that. But this is good. This means that you know, changes will propagate into pilots' hands much sooner, and that's great.
So is it primarily a matter of just getting the information? I mean, what, we had different kinds of information that was updated on different cycles. Is that the situation we've had historically?
That's exactly the case. So, for example, if you look at things like the chart supplement, formerly called the airport facility directory, the little green book, I believe that was either every 56 days or 28 days. It might have been 56. Instrument charts, I think, have been 28 days. So, yeah, there's a lot of different cycles for the different chart publications from the FAA.
And Max, how many of the changes that would be, you know, in that cycle were typically, would the pilot find them in NOTAMs versus having to go look at chart supplements or so forth? Is this going to make it easier for the pre-flight work for pilots?
Oh, I think you're right. I think many of those changes, but probably not all of them, were available in NOTAM form. And NOTAMs are kind of notorious for being hard to read and, you know, complex. Airline pilots complain about how, you know, on a particular flight they have, you know, they may have 100 NOTAMs that they have to scan through, you know, for a particular flight. So NOTAMs, yeah, those have been a difficult way to communicate, a difficult way for pilots to get information. It's been an easy way for the FAA to disseminate it.
So is this the FAA reflecting modern technology that they can update it sooner, I mean, and consolidate it? Is this a moving into the 21st century step, would you say?
Definitely. If you go back 20 years, pilots would, you know, run out and buy sectional charts every 6 months. Now most pilots probably use an electronic flight bag and get the data electronically. And of course, the app makers are then pulling that data from the FAA. So it just means that the app makers, for flight, Garmin Pilot, Sky Demon in Europe, people like that, they will now be pushing more data, you know, more often.
All right, very good. So there's really no downside to this, it sounds like.
No, that's great.
Yeah. Unless you're still buying paper charts, so then it's going to get more expensive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It hadn't occurred to me whether or not charts, the physical charts, will now be sold every 2 months. Does anybody buy those still?
Oh, dear. All right. This is an item that Micah sent in and comes from The Aviationist, which is David Cenciotti's military aviation blog. Well, we haven't had an item from that in quite a while, David. David Cenciotti is fantastic information that he publishes. But this is F-35 demo team forced to cut airshow appearances due to fleet-wide engine issues. So, of course, the F-35 uses the Pratt & Whitney F-135 engine, but it's been experiencing, in some cases, shorter than expected life with the turbine blades. Apparently, the F-35As, some of them, have been running pretty close to their design limits, which is causing premature cracks in the turbine blade coatings, which is not a flight safety issue, but it's a maintenance issue. It's causing premature engine removals, and I guess the depot system is apparently already backlogged, so this is adding additional workload to that. So this all is affecting the available engine supply, so the Air Force F-35 demonstration team is scaling back the number of airshow appearances by almost a third. Another hit to the airshows, this one coming from a different direction. So the military, especially fighter engines, run really hot temperature-wise. The higher the temperatures, the more power you're going to generate from them. And the F-35 engine is roughly 28,000 pounds of thrust, although on afterburner it goes up to 43,000 pounds of thrust. Those are published figures. And the turbine blades are operating in an environment that's hotter than the melting point of the metal. They can reach like 2,000 degrees Celsius. 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's really hot in there. And there are a variety of ways you can design a piece of metal to spin in an environment that exceeds its melting point. One is monocrystal blades. The turbine blades are each actually individual, a single crystal. And the design approach there is that you get, it's the 3C, you get creep, corrosion, and cracks. Generally, they start at the grain boundaries. So if you have a turbine blade that's only one crystal, there are no grain boundaries. So that helps the problem. They also have cooling passageways inside the turbine blades, and then little teeny tiny, usually laser drilled holes on the outside. And so you take bleed air off the compressor and use that actually as cooling air to go through the turbine blades, and it creates a like a boundary layer around the turbine blade for insulation. And then the third part of this that's relevant here is the thermal barrier coating, which is usually a ceramic. And that's what's at issue here with some micro cracks, I guess, developing in that. So it's something that will be examined. There are, you know, life cycle cost implications. And obviously, it's, you know, it's affecting the availability of engines in the field. So Pratt & Whitney's got some work to do, I guess, on those.
The number that they throw in here, that 20% of the engines in 2025 will be unserviceable, is really kind of a frightening thing. And we're only talking one service, and we're talking about the international version. So I'm wondering if it's going to carry through to the Marine, the B's and the C's, you know, the Navy as well as the Air, Marines. So as well, but. And definitely, I'm sure the international customers are keeping an eye out on it. It's just we've been flying them higher volume than everybody else. But you know, it's in this case, this is the engine manufacturer, not the aircraft manufacturer. So it's still, you know, aircraft procurement is not easy these days.
And yeah, I mean, not to make an excuse or anything, but you know, there are engineering challenges that come up, you know, with things like fighter aircraft that are designed to do things that previously hadn't been able to do before. So they're not perfect right out of the box for their entire lifetime, that's for sure. All right. Micah sent us well, this is a positive story of the week. Comes from KATU.com, that news station. Wrong Portland, TSA officer helps family fly to correct coast. This is always kind of funny. Well, it's not really funny, but, you know, what's the biggest problem with Portland? There's two of them, and they're on different sides of the United States. And so apparently there was a family of Spanish-speaking passengers, and they landed at Portland, Maine, only to discover that that's not Oregon. And so they were 2,500 miles away from where they wanted to be. So there were some, you know, some communications issues. I guess maybe this family, I don't know where they came from, but I guess maybe they didn't speak English or not well. But a TSA agent discovered the issue, spoke with them, and he escorted them to a ticket agent to see if they could get a ticket to the correct Portland. And while that was going on, he found that the family had been in the terminal overnight trying to figure out what was going on, I guess. And they only had $200, which is not going to get a family of three to Portland. So the TSA agent funded the difference, actually, and helped them book a flight to their destination. So kind of a good Samaritan story, above and beyond kind of a story. The TSA agent's name is Rios, I guess. And it's a great heartwarming story that he was able to help these people.
Yeah, let's hear it for Martin Rios. I think that's really awesome that he stepped up and did that. I think not only is it generous, but it certainly shows some great leadership qualities. So I think he will go far.
And he was recognized by the TSA. They gave him some kind of an award, some kind of a recognition award that I think is really deserved in this case.
We had something similar happen here in San Jose a few years ago. I remember reading about it in the newspaper. There are, of course, two San Jose's, and a lady arrived and wanted to go to a certain hotel, and they took her to the Fairmont, which was not the hotel she was looking for, but it was the closest thing the driver could come up with. And in the morning, she discovered that she was not in Costa Rica, but she was in San Jose, California. So an even bigger miss in terms of getting to the right airport.
Wait a minute, but doesn't that prompt, isn't there a song that says, "Don't you know the way to San Jose?"
There is, and I remember hearing her being interviewed. I forget who sings the song, and she, in the interview, said, nope, she has never actually been to San Jose, because that's up in Northern California, so 400 miles away from where she lives in Los Angeles. Dionne Warwick, I'm guessing. Yeah. I can't remember.
Ah, yes.
It's a Burke Bacharach song.
Oh, my gosh. Cool.
Hey, we got a real-time live update, by the way, on the Lear F5 autopilot.
Oh.
Yep. So the Collier Trophy was awarded in 1949, and it was said to be the first jet autopilot that could land in 00 weather. By 1956, they had sold 100,000 of these F5 autopilots. And so they may indeed have used it years later in the Learjet. But they had quite a market for these things before the invention of the Learjet. And there's a great story here about Bill Lear. At one point, he was with his family flying up, I think, from Michigan to California in a GA aircraft. He violated some restricted air zone. The fighters came up to check him out. And so he hid on the floor, and he put his son in the pilot seat and said, "When the jets come by, wave at the people," which is just the most amazing sense of humor. I mean, I love the guy. That's probably the best thing I've ever read about him.
That is so cool.
Can you imagine how they would report that? Hey, there's a 10-year-old flying this airplane.
Oh, you got to have a sense of humor.
Yep.
Again, we're joined by Chris Eads, AOPA's Senior Director, Outreach and Events. Chris, welcome again. So as we mentioned at the start of the show, it's been a tough year for aviation events and others as well, of course. And the main events that AOPA has held in the past have been the fly-ins, the regional fly-ins that long ago replaced the single event for the year. So we're looking at something a little bit different this year, Chris. We're looking at showcase events.
Yeah, absolutely. So it really, as you mentioned, Max, it has been a challenging year for aviation events all across the industry, and really, frankly, events all across the country of any area of interest. I remember very well as we were facing these initial cancellations back, almost a year ago now, 11 months ago when the pandemic hit. And the first to fall was Sun and Fun, and then it was one of our events, and one by one we kept holding out hope that, hey, in a couple of months everything will be back to normal. I seem to recall some pithy saying about 14 days to slow the spread, and we all thought that we'll hunker down for a couple of weeks and the world will be okay.
Yeah, we were overly optimistic.
We sure were, and we went through that cycle all year long. In fact, I remember at one point, we're about halfway through the year, and we finally waved the white flag and canceled our two fall fly-ins that we had scheduled in Wyoming and New York State. And I remember when we canceled the one in Rochester, we kind of had to. I mean, we were staring down the barrel at what was happening in New York State in particular, and we took a lot of negative fan mail, like, why are you canceling? Now, of course, hindsight 2020, everyone understood. So it was a tough year, tough process to go through.
Well, what about the commitments that you make? I mean, if you're organizing an event, obviously the planning starts long before the date the event. But isn't there, there's out-of-pocket expenses along the way.
Oh, exorbitant, yeah. And that's, I think folks may not realize that, these large-scale events. So when we were doing the AOPA fly-ins, the regional fly-ins, we started them in 2014, and we're averaging a couple thousand people per event. Last year, Max Trescott, you'll remember, in 2019, we had 10,000 people at each of our fly-ins. So over three fly-ins, 30,000 folks attended, all that. So when you're doing that scale of an event, it really is about an 18-month planning cycle from the process of defining what the event's going to be and then doing site research to find locations and get airports and communities involved. And there's all the fundraising components to it and developing sponsorships. And then you ultimately get down to, you know, making contracts to spend the money on infrastructure and marketing and those kinds of things. We were really, AOPA was really fortunate. When the pandemic hit, we were right at that final stage of finalizing all the infrastructure contracts, and were able to walk away with almost unhurt in that sense, that all the vendors we were working with were incredibly generous. You know, we moved a lot of stuff and credits into future years and those kinds of things. So we were, the timing of it, you know, we were really fortunate. But it does help us think through, how do you plan going forward? You know, we learned our lesson of how much you know, is at stake when you plan large events, you know, months and months and months in advance. There are commitments that have to be made, and so that really led us to think differently about 2021. You know, when we were starting the process, you know, normally, like I said, it's about an 18-month process. We can pull it off in, you know, 10 or 12 months if we had to, but that's really the shortest runway you can use to get these big events planned. So really, it was this past summer when we're having to start thinking about, what does next year look like? And we pretty quickly decided that it was going to be too risky, too iffy. You know, this whole sense that we've been overly optimistic, let's learn from that. Let's not be overly optimistic about what 21 will look like. And it was a tough call to decide last summer that we're not going to do regional fly-ins again in 2021. And at the time, we're all kind of thinking, well, that's crazy. This pandemic has got to be gone by then. Well, now here we sit and realize, boy, that was a really good call. To take another year off from our major events.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive to have that, you know, that much presence of mind last summer, or you know, what's gonna happen this year. So tell us about the two events that are planned.
Yeah, so we've got actually two completely different types of events, and we'll talk about the second one here maybe towards the end of our discussion here. But and that's a little bit more tentative, and I'll explain that to you here in a moment. But the primary flagship thing that we're going to do this year is hold a couple of what we're calling AOPA Aviator Showcase events. So these will have some of the same focus as our fly-ins, but purposely much, much smaller and a much narrower focus. And so what I mean by that is this, that we're going to take just the aircraft display and exhibit hall functions that you guys would be familiar with at our regional events. And we're going to build a one-day event around that component only. Okay, so just a chance for attendees to meet with industry experts around the technology and equipment and resources that we look for. So it's really kind of a shopping event, a buying event, if you will, where we're going to get together with all the industry leaders in avionics and aircraft manufacturing and equipment and resources and electronic flight bags and everything. Everything you could need as a pilot to you know, own an aircraft or fly an aircraft, that resource, that's all going to be together for just a short one-day event on a Friday. August 27th will be in Manassas, Virginia, and October 1st will be in Fort Worth, Texas. So we're going to do it a couple of times and give this a try and see how that works. A chance to bring the industry together with our membership and our attendees and aviation folks from around the country.
Are you planning on limiting attendance at all? Can you even limit attendance?
Well, yeah, and that's it's a great question and a really wise one, right? Because part of what we're looking at is, okay, what is the condition of the pandemic going to be even at the end of summer, right? So again, reference how optimistic we were a year ago that you know, hey, we were thinking last March, if you remember, we were thinking that by Oshkosh, this whole thing would be over.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, of course, we see how that all worked out. So we recognize that large events by nature, CDC and others are telling us these are super spreader potentials, and these are where the risks are really high. And so, you know, AOPA has chosen, rather than just be naively optimistic and, gee, we all want to get back to having big air shows and whatnot, we've said, let's take the conservative route, the careful route, primarily out of the interest of safety. We want to be sure that our guests and our attendees and our exhibitors and our sponsors, that everyone stays safe. And so, for that purpose, we're intentionally strategizing that we will limit attendance. It'll be a ticketed event, pre-registration required. No walk-ups will be permitted. Now, that's a major, major change for AOPA. We've always had an incredibly open door. You'll remember at our regional fly-ins, you could just show up unannounced, you know, get in the traffic pattern, be sure you've called the tower and come on in. Right. But we're saying, now this is because of the pandemic, this is a different ballgame. We've got to make it where it's you know, pre-registration required, ticketed event. There'll be a modest fee that'll help underwrite the cost of the event and so forth. What that'll allow us to do is, as we approach the event, we can look at what's the CDC recommending, what are the local health departments recommending in terms of crowd size, and we can set the attendance numbers accordingly. We're not even going to open ticket sales until about 12 weeks prior to the event. You know, we'll talk about, we'll market it, we'll say, hey, you know, 12 weeks out, we'll start opening ticket sales, so that we can get close enough to really get a feel for where are the health recommendations from the government at that time, and set the limits accordingly.
Do you think that you could end up having to institute a lottery system for the tickets?
Well, you know, there have been a few events where we have done, you know, tickets, like we've done some excursions and some fly out events that have been attached to our fly-ins that had limited numbers that were put in place. And typically what we did is we just gave a lot of advance notice to when ticket sales will open. And it's first come, first serve. And when they sell out, they sell out. Years ago, we had a special excursion we were doing to a really privileged floor tour of the Boeing factory in Seattle. We actually got to on the floor with our attendees, and we had 100 slots because that's all they gave us. They said no more than 100 people. We advertised when we were going to open it at noon on such and such a day to open registration. It sold out in 11 minutes.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah. So, you know, we might be in that kind of scenario with these. We don't know. Now, all that said, you know, that's our plan today because we want to be responsible. So if the government says, hey, 500 people spread over the course of the day, it's an indoor and outdoor experience, large hangar, 500 folks is okay. Well, that'll be our limit. If they say you can do 1,000 or you can do 2,000, we'll set the limit wherever it is. If we're all surprised that by August, all Americans have been vaccinated and CDC says, throw your masks away, don't need them anymore, and go to rock concerts together and all that, then we'll set the limit at whatever the physical capacity of the airfield is. And part of that's going to be directed by the airports to say, here's what we can handle capacity wise. And then we'll set those numbers accordingly. But, you know, we've just been overly optimistic in the past. So this time we're saying, let's be cautious. Let's figure this out from the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds wise to me. What other protocols do you expect visitors to encounter? Other organizations I've seen have talked about proof of vaccination or, you know, some other kinds of restrictions or requirements for attendees.
Yeah, I think part of that, we'll get a little later in the year and find out what's being recommended. That's partly why we strategically placed both these events in the fall. You know, August 27th is effectively beginning of fall, right? So we placed them later in the year so we'd have time for the vaccinations to work their course and so forth. So we'll see where, you know, probably mid, you know, early summer, we'll probably get a feel for what's the CDC recommending, what are other large events doing. Certainly we're going to keep our eye very keenly on what Oshkosh does, EAA Air Venture does, to learn from some of their best practices and so forth. That'll be a forerunner to our events, and we can, you know, apply some of those lessons learned. But, you know, I think largely, we're designing the event to be very socially distanced and spread out, right? So it's an indoor-outdoor event in the sense that we'll have the traditional exhibit booths, you know, the pipe and drape exhibit hall kind of experience. But these are going to be in large 30,000-square-foot hangars where we can really spread out and we can create much more generous aisles than we typically would. We're going to put the booths in just little pods of four with higher pipe and drape between them so that, you know, there's a little bit more isolation, and every booth becomes a corner booth, if you will. And so there's lots of opportunities for folks to spread out. We'll resource exhibitors with plexiglass if that's what they would desire to have, and those kinds of things, extra sanitizing stations and whatnot. So all those various kind of protocols, we will most likely require masks, you know, if that's still what's being recommended at the time, those kinds of things. So we feel like we can create all the systems and protocols that will match or exceed what CDC is recommending at the time these events come to pass, with, of course, the hope and optimism that things are improving enough that we can relax some of that as we get closer to it.
Are you getting, David?
No, I wanted to compliment AOPA. We talk about this, and Max Trescott says this a lot, about the culture of safety.
Yep.
And pilots have a culture of being safe and being more conservative than, you know, and it looks like the event planning is taking that kind of turn, that mentality is going also towards, it's kind of nice to see the culture that we build as in aviation transfer over to the pandemic transition, et cetera. So it was an interesting parallel in my mind.
Yeah. And it really has been from the beginning as we started facing this back in March. And we're, you know, part of working at AOPA, we're very privileged to be around some of the greatest minds in aviation safety. So for example, our Air Safety Institute that I'm sure many of you are very familiar with, they've actually been key consultants with us on every event model, every idea. We believe it or not, we've had about 20 different ideas on the marker board over the last, 6 to 8 months. Of how do we open up? How do we get the aviation industry connected with pilots and aviation enthusiasts? And so we've had a lot of different things we've tested and tried, at the marker board level, the theoretical level, and Air Safety Institute and their leadership, among others, have been part of helping us evaluate. We take it pretty serious, and we're enjoying the fact that we're coming up with some ideas we think will work.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of, or it hadn't occurred to me that the Air Safety Institute would be a resource in terms of planning these things. Are you getting any kind of feedback, suggestions from others involved in events like this? For example, the exhibitors, are you hearing concerns, or are they just more than happy to get in front of the public again? What are they saying?
Well, yeah, really, it's actually there's sort of a parallel set of anxieties that most in the aviation industry are feeling. On the one hand, the sales side of the organizations, they're anxious and eager to get in front of pilots and aircraft owners, which we obviously represent well, and so they're anxious to get with our folks. However, at the same time, they're having the same concerns about safety. And so part of, as we even looked at the date selection for when we would do these events, we spent quite a bit of time consulting with a number of different of our friends and partners in the industry, other organizations and folks who would ultimately be exhibitors and sponsors with us. And, we were hearing a lot of the same thing, that even their concerns about having their employees travel to events early in the year, just a lot of anxiety about whether that was going to be safe or not. So we took all that to heart and listened carefully to say of course, we all want to get back to fly-ins and events, and we all want to hang out around the campfire, so to speak. But we got to do it in a responsible way. And so we've weighed all that evidence. And so far, all the reaction has been from the exhibitors and sponsors and so forth has been, bravo, thanks for coming up with some great ideas. And intentionally, we're even, setting all the registration processes much later in the year so folks can kind of approach it with a wait and see, and great idea. And we'll see how things look this summer as to whether or not we'll be able to really pull it off in the fall.
Now, earlier you hinted about another kind of event that AOPA is considering.
Yeah, well, and it's sort of quote unquote on the books, but very, very tentative. So, and we've written about this in a couple of articles you've probably seen in AOPA Pilot Magazine and other places, that when the pandemic clears enough that it appears to be safe and the recommendations from CDC and whatnot would suggest that we could, in fact, travel state to state to state. One of the things we've envisioned doing is what we call a pilot gathering air tour, where we would essentially load up, half dozen small aircraft with folks from AOPA, and we would just kind of do an old barnstormers tour, hop from town to town, and go and drop in and visit with folks for a simple 2 or 3 hour event, just get a couple hundred folks together for a pilot town hall and a safety lecture and a round table lunch discussion and so forth. So we're really excited about that being sort of an opening act for getting back on the social side of things when it's appropriate. But, we've got that plan. It's kind of spring loaded, ready to go, but we've put it on the shelf until we get the news that the pandemic is supporting that kind of activity. Now, the theory behind it was, right, with the showcase event, you noticed in doing the aviator showcases, it's just an exhibit event, just a technology event, and we stripped away all the social activities that you would expect at our original fly-in. So we're not doing the concerts and the hangouts and the dinner parties and all those things that have that potential to be more of a spreader event. So we wanted to replace, we've taken those social elements away from our events. We wanted to bring them back in when we can, and that's where this air tour component comes in, where it's really just a grassroots, let's fly across country and hang out in small groups with aviators all across the U.S. and do it all by GA, you know, a very cost-effective way to go about it. So once we're allowed to do that, based on health recommendations, that's what we're going to do. We hope we can do that this fall. It may have to wait till next spring. We'll just kind of see what how the pandemic unfolds and how the recovery is going.
And then longer term, are the regional fly-ins still in the cards, or is that something that's not going to reappear?
Well, you know, I think it's a great question. I think all of us would love for them to be back in the cards. At the same time, you know, we're looking at these newer, smaller event models. We kind of want to see how they go this year. And, you know, as we mentioned, there's an 18-month planning cycle to do the big events. And so for fly-ins in 2022, we'd have to be working at it right now, which, you know, we're behind the scenes noodling on it, that kind of thing. But again, it's the when are we going to be in position nationally where the news cycle is such that we have confidence we can execute major large-scale events again the way that we like to do them. Once we know that we can do that, well, then we'll begin that planning process. But it may be we might get into this year and have so much fun doing these showcases and the air tour. You know, who knows? We might be onto something that's kind of a new way of doing things for a while. So kind of all up in the air.
And when we went from the single annual event to the regional fly-ins, I mean, that was kind of a decentralization a little bit of, you know, of all of the social and the commercial and all of the things that you want to accomplish in total. So, yeah, I mean, why not also look at going one step further, you know, and taking the regional fly-ins and making them even smaller and more distributed to potentially more people? I mean, yeah, it's worth maybe considering.
Yeah, and really it's all of this is kind of, you know, at this stage, just brainstorming. You know, what our chief objective is, we want to get with both our members and then also pilots and aviation enthusiasts around the country who maybe not aren't members with us yet. We'd love to, we want to hang out with and connect with aviators and aviation enthusiasts wherever they are. That was the big thing. We went from the annual convention to the regional fly-ins. The whole mantra was we want to go where pilots want to be on the weekends, and that's at the local airport.
Right.
And we really were very successful with that. But as they've grown, then they've kind of turned into little mini conventions of their own. And so part of the questioning is, could we do better to go back to even smaller gatherings, purposeful smaller gatherings, where that relational quotient, that ability to connect and have meaningful conversations and so forth is even more plausible. So all stuff that we're thinking about and trying to, you know, keep our finger on the pulse of where pilots are and what the industry needs and wants and keep folks encouraged.
Chris, tell us a little bit about how the process of planning these events works within AOPA. It's not just you making decisions. It probably involves other people within the organization.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It really is a very collective effort. So I have the privilege of leading our outreach and events team, which is a staff of professional event planners. We're also all aviators, and so we've got that connection to aviation, but have event planning experience and skills. And so we do a lot of the heavy lift and the legwork and so forth. But the core decision-making, the visioning of what we're trying to accomplish, where we want to do it, even the strategic thought around the types of events we want to do, a lot of that is a very collaborative, brainstormed process. You know, we involve all the different departments of AOPA, all the various brands and product services, and really rely heavily on the folks in our organization who have the deepest connection to the various industry partners, exhibitors, and manufacturers, and so forth, that we try to get a real pulse for what does the industry as a whole want and need in the events. And so I lead the process with those thinkers and that group into working the process strategically, thinking through what does it look like and what could we do this next year and so forth. But we vet those plans and those ideas through a number of different layers of decisions and so forth to ultimately come out with the event product for the year. The other thing we do, we actually work pretty collaboratively with airports all across the country. In most years, we'll have out an RFP of sorts, a request for proposals for airports to pitch at us that they'd like to host us for the various types of events that we're doing. And so that becomes even a process, you know, interviewing airports and working with those communities and airport commissions and local, you know, visitors bureaus and whatnot to determine the best locations to go as well, which is also a fun part of networking around the industry.
How are airports interested in hosting or providing the venue for events like this? What do they get out of it?
Well, they get a lot. And actually, we really find a lot of airports providing interest. Probably the two largest things they get is exposure, number one. That, you know, pilots, and I often say this when I'm talking to visitors bureaus at local communities and talking about the value of the event, is, you know, we think about it, we're going to market an event. We're going to market your airport, your community, to a group of people who own airplanes and are looking for places to go on the weekends. I mean, what better qualified audience, you know, for folks that are trying to build, you know, industry. So airports get a lot of exposure. The communities themselves get a lot of exposure. We make it very, very purposeful. Tell the story, not just of the airfield, but of the businesses on the airfield and the attractions in the community and what the community has to offer. You know, partly we're hoping that pilots will come to one of our events because they're interested in getting something new for their aircraft or their avionics set or whatnot. But they're going to discover that this town, this city, this airport, there's other things to do here, and they want to come back multiple times. You know, we're partly trying to inspire people to use their airplanes and travel and go places. So that helps us. And the second thing airports get is actually the direct business. You know, when you think about as a pilot, we tend to choose fuel stops and places where we do our business at airports we've had good experiences with. We've flown into them before. We know what's there. We know I can expect a good level of customer service here. So if we can give pilots a great experience through an event at an airfield they'd never been to before, and they get to know the FBO, they get to see the maintenance shop on the airfield, whatnot, it really does engender a different level of loyalty, which then becomes a real asset in return to the airports for hosting.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation because, well, for several reasons, but for me personally, as you've mentioned, and as I think the case with all of us, we just love to get back to the events that, you know, we know and love from the past. We want to do that, but we don't want to jump too fast, too soon. We want to do it safely. And I think that your description of how these events have come together and how they've been planned and organized really shows that, you know, AOPA has got safety front of mind when it comes to creating these events and designing different kinds of events than we've seen in the past. So I think that's really exciting. How did you get to AOPA? Did you just wake up one morning and say, I wonder if I could go work with these guys? This would be a lot of fun.
Well, actually, yes, that's exactly how it happened.
Really?
So I've been an AOPA member for many, many years. I got my private pilot's license in 2001. However, I started flight training when I was a teenager in the 1980s and then had just set it aside, you know, in my college years, didn't have the money for it and was on a different career path and whatnot. But I've been a member of AOPA now for years and flying recreationally. I live not far from Frederick, Maryland, and so knew of AOPA's physical location, but, you know, read their magazine religiously and so forth. And one day when I was contemplating a career change, I seriously thought, man, I would love to go work for these guys. And I got to tell you, it was really a neat experience interviewing there. And here I am sitting in an interview room with people that I've been reading their stories in the magazines and like, wow, this is pretty cool. And it really has proven to be just a wonderful place to work. What's unique about it is the level of passion that almost everyone in the organization, either as a pilot, an active pilot, or they've got some real deep tie and connection to aviation. And so everyone's working not just out of a, hey, this is a cool job, it's a nice company to work for, but they're working out of a deep, deep passion for the industry, deep passion for what we do. And I think that's pretty exceptional. I think, you know, for a workforce as large as we have, that's pretty rare to be around colleagues that are there such a high percentage. I'm thinking in the 80, 90 percentile of we're here because we love it. We love what this organization represents. And it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do think that is kind of unique. I mean, it does happen in other companies, but I think by and large, it's the exception that everybody is aligned in that way. I mean, in large corporations, people tend to be more aligned with their profession. So if they're in finance, it's, you know, they're a finance person first, and then, you know, whatever the product or service the company is offering is maybe secondary. And that's, I think that's typical, but to find.
Yeah, and that's, and where we see the uniqueness there. So like, I think around, like, think about our IT department, I think about our finance department, and you're right. That most companies, the passion is around the role, but, you know, our vice president of IT is a very avid pilot, you know, and, you know, it, you just think through all the, I'm thinking all these different faces and these different, you know, departments that they just love aviation. And so, yeah, they might be bookkeepers, they might be technology folks, but man, we love airplanes. We love what we do.
Great. All right. Tell our listeners once again, the dates and locations.
Yeah. So the Aviator Showcases, two of them, both of them will be on Fridays. August 27th is a Friday. It'll be in the Manassas, Virginia airport, hosted by Chantilly Air. And that'll be August 27th. And then October 1st will be at Alliance Fort Worth, the Alliance airport there, and hosted by the FBO there. So October 1st in Fort Worth, Texas, August 27th, Manassas, Virginia.
Sounds fantastic. Chris, we really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to our audience about these events. I hope the number of tickets that are going to ultimately be available are enough to satisfy the demand. But we'll see.
Yeah, we sure do as well. We hope so.
Thanks, Chris. On to some listener mail. We can touch on a few items. We heard from Tom. We talked about the Super Bowl flyover, the three bombers, I think last episode. And Tom sent us a link that's on the drive. Check out these stunning images of the Super Bowl's bomber trio flyover. And so we'll put that in the show notes. You can take a look at those. That's pretty exciting. And then he also sent us another email. And this is something that probably David knows all about, but I didn't. It's an item from something called taskandpurpose.com. And it's, here's why Army helicopters have Native American names. So they talk about, you know, the Black Hawk, Apache, the Comanche, the Lakota. For some reason, I just had never made the connection that the naming was related in that way. So, David, the history of this sort of naming convention is rather interesting.
I mean, the Army has always named, you know, and the aircraft helicopters have always had the name, with the exception, even the beloved Huey is the Iroquois. So, is the technical name, you know. Eventually, the Army rescinded the order that they be named after Native American tribes, but the tradition sort of has continued. But and ironically, the Black Hawk was, you know, it was kind of an interesting little pun, because that way all of the other hawks that came through, like the Jayhawk, the Seahawk, and stuff, but the Black Hawk being a tribe is one of the other ones. But all of them from the beginning of Army flying helicopters, they have been named after tribes, and I don't see them not continuing it. I mean, it's an honorific, and I haven't really seen any Native American uproar over these military aircraft being named after tribes.
No, in fact, I see here that in some cases, at least maybe more recently, the tribes were consulted about the naming of these aircraft, and, you know, if they were agreeable to it, which I think is really fantastic. The original names, it says, for the first two helicopters were Hoverfly and the Dragonfly. And the Army General, Hamilton Howes, he didn't like those names. And he decided, it says, the next helicopter would be called the Sioux, quote, in honor of the Native Americans who fought Army soldiers in the Sioux Wars and defeated the 7th Cavalry Regiment at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And so that spawned in 1969 Army Regulation 70-28 that required that Army aircraft be named after Indian terms and names of American Indian tribes and chiefs. And then, but it also has some more. It says that it also directed that the tanks would be named after American generals and that infantry weapons would receive the names for famous early American pioneers. And assault weapons would be named after fearsome reptile and insect names, which is pretty pretty humorous.
Which is how AH-1s got around being not named after a Indian tribe. The AH-1 is the Cobra because it was a gunship.
Ah, okay. Fascinating. And the last piece of really interesting information here is it says that 32 Native Americans have earned the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest military award. 32 of them have. So, yeah, thanks, Tom, for that. That's that was very interesting. I didn't know that stuff at all. And then we heard from Harold. We've been talking about several things in the past. One is the military testing GPS jamming. And Harold sent us an article from the IEEE that says, or is titled, "The FAA Files Reveal a Surprising Threat to Airline Safety, the U.S. Military's GPS Tests." And he says that he being Harold, said that he didn't realize that GPS was used for precision approaches. This is, you know, an example of when the military is testing jamming, spoofing GPS signals and so forth. Well, there have been a number of commercial flights that have lost their GPS signal because of this activity going on and has led to some moments, let's say, where, you know, other action had to be taken. Max, do you think, you know, is switchover from reliance on GPS to all of a sudden it's not available because of this military activity? Is that a difficult moment?
Well, I think that it is something that we all have to deal with going forward in the future for a variety of reasons. Certainly, there's military testing. If you were to look at kind of the worst possible scenario, what if there's, you know, outright war and people decide to take out some of our GPS satellites? And so part of the reason I think the FAA has left in place a small network of VORs is just for backup purposes. You know, they would love to get rid of that network of 1950s technology because they're expensive to maintain. And they have a limited number of them, but I think they're going to keep a network of them in place just for those purposes. For the encounters that I have read about where airliners have lost GPS, most of the time they just kind of calmly announce to ATC, "Hey, we've lost GPS." And ATC says, "Yeah, we're hearing that from other airliners in your area." And they just continue on to fly. You know, in the worst case, ATC can give them headings and vectors to follow. They can also rely on the backup network of VORs. I'm trying to think what would be the worst possible scenario. Probably if you were flying a GPS-based approach and you were getting down low close to the ground, in which case an airliner would probably just fly the missed approach procedure. So I think that we've got contingencies for just about all the different kind of GPS interruptions that might happen.
Well, that's good, because it really sounds like you need a plan B for this sort of thing. You know, in this case, it's because of things that the United States military is doing, but, you know, as we know, it's really easy to interfere with or take down GPS, and, you know, should somebody decide that that's what they want to do on a wide scale, it could be problematic.
And I think that pilots are just, by their very nature and training, used to having a plan B and having a plan C. I mean, it's really just second nature because, you know, so much of the time there's uncertainty as to whether we can complete the mission as planned. So, you know, we have to be thinking always about what if, you know, what if the winds are more adverse? You know, what if we encounter, you know, thunderstorms? What if, what if, what if? And so, yeah, most pilots really should be thinking about plan B and plan C before they even take off. And things like this, these are the kinds of things that, you know, people should really kind of think through from the comfort of their easy chair. One of the things I heard a couple years ago was a surgeon who was a low-time pilot. He said that when he teaches surgery, that he teaches a new surgeon to write down a list of all the different possible things that could go wrong, and then write down, you know, what he will do in each of those situations. And he said, as a new pilot, he applied the same thing to aviation, came up with a list of 68 things that could go wrong, which I was pretty impressed with. And, I think that's what pilots need to do. You know, just sit back in your easy chair. And if you have a plan ahead of time for all the different things that might go wrong, you are going to be in much better shape when they do go wrong, rather than kind of come up with the seat of the pants, answer, which is, usually not going to be as good as the forethought you may have given to it. And David's holding up a sign there. It says,
plan ahead. It was raining when Noah built the ark.
It wasn't raining.
Oh, it wasn't raining.
Raining when Noah built the ark.
Oh, that's what it says. I see that. Okay. Well, now that makes more sense.
Well, and this from a guy who's worked in the insurance industry. That makes total sense.
That does.
It's funny that this goes back to our conversation with you, that, all of the planning and having backup plans and secondary plans that your guys are going through, I guess it's just part of the culture.
It really is. And I think if nothing else, 2020 and now 21 has taught us, change is inevitable. And sometimes it comes very quickly and very unexpectedly. And so, to have plans, I mean, Max is talking about just good aviating skill sets is to know your backups for all the various things that go wrong. That's applicable to so many things in life, not just flying airplanes.
You know, Chris, just between you and me, when I listen to Max Trescott, I always come away thinking, boy, that really illustrates how important your flight instructor is in creating the type of pilot you become. Wouldn't you agree? What kind of flight instructor did you have? Did you have like an amazing flight instructor?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would concur that the flight instructor that I had was actually an airline pilot. He was young, and he was renting a room from me at kind of as a crash pad thing. But he still had his instructor certificate. So he traded me free rent for flight instruction, which was a good deal. Yeah. And he taught me to what I was really thankful for as a private pilot. He taught me to commercial standards. He said all the maneuvers, all the things that the standards you would have to have to pass a commercial check ride, that's what I expect out of you at the private, which helped me a lot, because then as a private pilot, it's not like I probably wouldn't have been able to go pass a commercial check ride, but the tolerances, he taught me to be much, much stricter in my tolerances, which, I think has served me very well through the years.
Well, this is good. This has given me some keen insight here. And so I think, Chris, I'll be hitting you up at some future event for, I'll trade you free flight instruction for a booth, right there by the entrance of the event.
There you go.
Well, on this issue.
But you know what? In all fairness, Chris is, we've talked about that if you want to be a pilot and money is an object or right, here's another example of somebody working a deal to get their flight instruction, which we always want to encourage. That's always been an important part is if you want to fly, figure it out. And here was another example. Here's another example. Okay, room and board for flight instructions. Okay, but it might be sweeping out a hangar or something. But if you want to fly, go do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, don't let money stop you. There's always a way.
Chris, do you think that student pilots are that they evaluate flight instructors to the degree they should? I mean, that's a broad statement, but I mean, do you think people are discriminating enough when it comes to selecting flight instructors that, are good, A, and B, are a good fit for them?
Yeah, and I think you self-acknowledge it's a broad question, and there's probably not an answer that fits everyone, but I think the premise of what you're saying is a great idea, that I do believe that part of what makes flight training successful is the chemistry between the student and the instructor. And so to shop for chemistry and competency and cost, all of those are all factors that you're weighing in when you're thinking about flight training. But I do think that chemistry component is really key. And I was very fortunate to have an instructor who he was flying for the airlines. He'd already made it. He'd already had instructed threw the hours he needed to earn his ATP, and he was out there flying in the left seat for the regional airlines. And yet he was still passionate about instructing. And that's why he found joy in doing that. And that's, I think, a big thing. I would suggest that that's maybe one of the most important pieces of chemistry is the instructor there because they love teaching and they love general aviation. They love this phase of flying, the stick and rudder phase of flying. And that when I've been around instructors like that, they're just contagious. I just love it.
Magic happens.
Yeah.
Well said, Chris.
Yeah, very well said. All right. Oh, we have more with Harold's email, though, now that I've taken us off in that direction.
And there's more.
We had talked about the DARPA disc rotor before. Was that last episode, I think? Well, Harold says that this concept was patented and pioneered by Alan Gerbino and Eli Alexander of Gerbino Flight Systems. He said I had the good fortune to meet both of them, although I never made it to their shop where they were working on a prototype aircraft. So he provided a link. This is at vtol.org, and it's a publication titled Gerbino Flight Systems Innovation in Flight. And it's a 29-page document that you can purchase for $20. And he also attached an illustration. He said their work inspired this illustration, which he did in 2008. And it's a really nice illustration that Harold has done of one of these kinds of aircraft, which if you hadn't listened to last week's episode, you think of a kind of like a helicopter, but with a disc where the rotor blades would be with shorter airfoils extending out from that disc. Yeah, take a look at the show notes and you'll see the image that Harold created. All right. With that, I think we're ready to wrap up this episode. We really want to thank you, Chris. Chris Eads, AOPA Senior Director, Outreach and Events. Chris, good to have you with us. I'll say the same thing I say every time that there's somebody from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association on the show, which is that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or a pilot in order to join AOPA, which is how I got involved in the organization some years ago. So consider it because, you know, it's a great organization that advocates for aviation, whether you're a pilot or not, and it's you know, worthy of your support.
And lots of resources, you know, magazines and various media channels, lots of stuff that, you know, anyone who's into aviation, it's a great place to be a part of and belong. So we appreciate your support and your involvement, and great to be with you guys tonight.
Thank you, yes. And, of course, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode, the direct link is airplanegeeks.com/641, and our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Drescott, where do they find you?
Well, let's see. Just want to mention quickly that this week on Aviation News Talk, episode 178, Rob Mark is on the show. And speaking of safety, we're talking about SOPs, standard operating procedures for GA pilots. And, of course, you can find the show anywhere you get podcasts or go out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact, and you can shoot me an email.
And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Oh, the usual places, you know, Twitter, Facebook, our Slack listener team, which you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and you can join that conversation. And, of course, you can find me on Monday mornings in your ears with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
Very good. Yeah, you can find me at 30,000feet.com. All words, no spaces, spelled out. And you learn all the social media and other things that I do at that site. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.